Ki seitze la milchama al oyevecha unsano adonai elohecha biadecha vishavisa shivyo. When you go out to war against your enemies, and Hashem your God will deliver them into your hand, and you will capture its captivity. OU Israel presents
Come in. Welcome.
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky, and this show is for Parshat Ki Teitze. Recording and first broadcast, Yom Chamishi, Thursday, the ninth day of Elul, 5774, corresponding to September 4th. Let's do Tehillim Kuf Lamed, Psalm 130, and then we'll talk about the Sedra and other things. Shir hama'alot mima'amakim karaticha Adonai. Adonai shima v'koli tihyena oznecha kashuvot l'kol tachanunai. Im avonot tishmor yoh Adonai mia amod, ki imacha hasalicha l'ma'an tivarei. Ki viti Adonai kivata nafshi v'lidvoro hochalti. Nafshi l'Adonai mi shomerim l'boker, shomerim l'boker. Yachel Yisrael el Adonai ki im Adonai hachesed v'harbe imo fedut v'hu yifdeh et Yisrael mikol avonotav. Achenu kol beit Yisrael hanatunim batzara v'ashivya ha'omedim ebein bayam uvein bayabasha ha'makom yirachem aleihem v'yotzieim mitzara l'yirvacha u'meyafela l'ora u'mishibud l'geula hashta ba'agala u'vizman kariv v'nomar. Amen. A little old business first. You know that I try to begin each half of each show with some kind of theme music, very often a television show theme, just because there's a lovely website called televisiontunes.com and amazing selection there. And I try to think of something from the Sedra that triggers a memory of a particular show, or vice versa, find a show that will trigger something in the Parsha. Now last week, the first half, I started with the theme music from the comedy called Night Court. And that was meant to be Shofetim v'Shotrim, judges and officers, because I was thinking not only of Judge Harry, but also of Bull, who was the bailiff. So you had Shoftim and Shotrim. Then I got to the second half of the show, and after debating with myself, I decided to play a clip from The Sorcerer's Apprentice, the one with the video from Fantasia with Mickey Mouse playing the Sorcerer's Apprentice. I had a little mixed feelings there, because sorcery in its real serious form is forbidden by Torah law. And by the way, which we didn't discuss last week, but the black arts in general, the occult arts, are forbidden by Jewish law, by Torah law. The question is whether they are forbidden because they are baloney and a waste of time and something that pulls one away from proper belief in God, which is one possibility as expressed by some of the sources which we have. And the other possibility is that there is something to it, and yet we're not allowed to do those things. Our relationship is to be more straightforward with God. The prohibitions as they are in Shofetim are followed by the famous pasuk, Tamim Tihyeh Im Hashem Elokecha. Be simple, straightforward, above the board with God. And we have obligations to listen to a Navi and to listen to the authorities, halachic authorities of our generations. And that's what we rely on, not divination and not astrology and not conjuring and not sorcery or any of those kind of things. Anyway, I decided to put it on. I think I ended up cutting it much shorter because of going over time. Then I explained then that sorcery had these negative things attached to it, so I really didn't know why I should use it. That's not really the way I said it, doesn't matter. But I said, now come to think of it, there's something wrong with the opening music from the first half. A number of listeners emailed me with the correct solution to that cryptic statement of mine, and that is Night Court, even though it represents judges, was not the best choice because our Beit Din, our Sanhedrin, cannot adjudicate at nighttime. It's a daytime function. That's why when we had, and will have again, the setting up of the calendar based on eyewitness testimony to the first visibility of the lunar crescent, witnesses were heard at nighttime by a committee of Sanhedrin members, but no pronouncement of Rosh Chodesh could be made until sunrise, because it's an act of Beit Din, an act of the court, and the court can't act officially at nighttime. So witnesses could come at 6:30 in the evening, and the judges have their testimony, and yet everybody has to wait for the official announcement by the Nasi after sunrise the following morning. And that actually has a halachic ramification, that if a person forgets to say Ya'aleh v'yavoh in the Amidah of Arvit Ma'ariv of Rosh Chodesh, he doesn't have to repeat the Amidah. Why, says the Gemara? Because Ein Mekadshin et HaChodesh Balayla, because you don't sanctify the month at nighttime. Even though you see the moon at nighttime and you testify at nighttime, the testimony is not acted upon by an official proclamation of the court until sunrise. So, for those readers who wrote that to me, I give you a kol hakavod, and it's nice to see reactions to the show in general and to the little bit of shtick that I try to put in. This week's opening is a well-known theme song from a sitcom. A lot of people didn't like the idea of making a situation comedy out of that particular topic, which I'm not going to tell you because I need an answer from listeners again. And that is why, out of all of the themes that I could have chosen for the opening words of the Torah in this week's Sedra, why did this particular show fit better and maybe was more appropriate than any of the other options, of which there were many? If that's cryptic, let it be. If that's clear to some people, which I'm sure it is, then let me know at tt@ou.org. And that's it. Okay, down to business, as the expression goes. Parshat Ki Teitse, 110 verses, 110 psukim, has 74 out of the 613 mitzvot. Specifically, 27 out of the 248 positive commands, and 37 out of the 365 prohibitions. 12% of the mitzvot of the Torah are in this week's Sedra. There is no other Sedra with as many mitzvot. 74 mitzvot. Now, I believe that the fact that the month of Elul begins with mitzvah-heavy Sedras, last week Shofetim and this week Ki Teitse, the week before Re'eh, 170 mitzvot among them, is sort of like a statement to say, yes, there's an agenda for the month of Elul, and people have to do a lot of introspection and contemplation and self-improvement. But the bottom line is mitzvot, because mitzvot says it all. Mitzvot includes not only ritualistic kind of behavior between man and God, it includes an amazing variety of interpersonal relationships. And the mitzvot, not just in Parshat Ki Teitzeh, although with so many mitzvot we have some good examples, show very much the kind of people that God wants us to be. And therefore I think it's not a separate thing to study mitzvot and to relate to the fact that it's the month of Elul with the approaching Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. But self-improvement as a Jew means paying closer attention to mitzvot to improve the quality of the performance of the mitzvot which we do, to start doing some of the mitzvot which we don't, and when it comes to prohibitions, to be more careful and more careful not to violate, and maybe most important vis-a-vis Elul and its agenda would be to learn lessons from the study of mitzvot that apply to a wider kind of style of behavior. I'll give you an example. The Torah, in a few different places, I think it starts in Mishpatim, and there are a whole bunch of the mitzvot here in Ki Teitzeh, and Re'eh had some, on the topic of lending and borrowing. Now, the first step is that there is such a thing, that people do lend money to other people. And the Torah makes it a mitzvah. If you could afford to lend if you could afford to lend money to a friend in need, that's a big mitzvah. Im kesef talveh et ami. Then comes the topic of taking interest on a personal loan, and this is only the surface presentation. There's more, but that won't get to my point. The basic rule of the Torah, very strongly emphasized, is the prohibition of taking interest on a personal loan from Jew to Jew. Interestingly, the Torah makes a point of telling us that when it comes to borrowing from a non-Jew, we may pay interest, and when it comes to lending to a non-Jew, we may take interest. That's the way of the world. Now, I have to add very quickly here that there has been a lot of vilification of the Jewish people through the Middle Ages on this Shylock kind of syndrome of charging exorbitant interest, taking usury, which is an abomination, not just in Judaism, but in all civilized societies. So I'm not talking about excessive interest. I'm not talking about interest that will send the borrower further into the poorhouse. We're talking about a modest amount of interest, which the world seems to feel a lender is entitled to. And Judaism recognizes that a lender is entitled to make a little modest profit on money of his that he lends. But when it comes to helping out a fellow, the flavor that we pick up, the lead that we pick up from God, is that he wants us to go beyond the norm of the world and not make a penny in interest on a personal loan. He allows us to take a mashkon, a security for the loan, and that means if the borrower has a valuable silver Hanukkah menorah, he could give that to you as a security for the few thousand shekels, dollars, or whatever you lent him. But another thing in the Torah, in this week's Sedra, if it comes Hanukkah time, and true, he was supposed to pay you back by the summer, and Hanukkah was not an issue at all. He borrowed the money after Hanukkah last year. He was supposed to pay you back during the summer. He wasn't able to pay you back. And week by week, things went on, and it's Hanukkah time now. You're obligated to return the Hanukkah candle, Hanukkah menorah, to him to use on Hanukkah. If he gave you as a security his wife's fur coat because it was summertime and it wasn't needed, when it becomes needed, even if he hasn't returned it, the money, you have to return the security that he gave for the use. You're not allowed to take objects that are used to make food as a security in the first place. You can't, you have additional restrictions on taking securities from a widow. Now, all of these things go beyond the, quote, business side of lending and borrowing. Again, you look in the world abhors the loan shark, usury. It's associated with organized crime, and it bleeds the borrower dry and creates all kind of other problems. But the world recognizes, after all, you don't have to give the money. Judaism says, yes, you do, if you could afford it. But the world says, no, you don't have to lend money if you don't want to, and if you do, you're entitled to make money. If you would invest the money, you would make a return on it. So if you lend it, you're entitled to get something back. And the borrower is very often thrilled and delighted to pay a little extra in order to get the loan. So everybody's happy. Except when we're talking about the Jewish people and the Torah, God is not happy. He does not want you to profit from the loan which you give to your fellow who is in need. I'm not discussing now the ramifications of a business kind of loan where there is a halachically acceptable way to profit from it. If you could lose from it, heter iska, that's beside the point. My point is that there are several mitzvot, positive and prohibitions, dealing with lending and borrowing, and one scratches his head and says, wait a minute, why, if I am not being paid back, should I give something of value that I am holding in exchange for the loan in order to guarantee the return of the loan? Why should I give that back before it's paid? And the Torah says, yes, it's as if God says to us, yes, I know it doesn't make sense, and I know it's not logical, and I know the rest of the world doesn't have to live by this higher standard. But you have to recognize that the fact that you had money and you were able to lend it is something that is a chesed, a kindness by God towards you. And he's expecting you to pay it forward, so to speak, and an act of kindness to your fellow. Now, you're entitled to the loan back. You don't have to give him the money, although tzedakah is another form of gemilut chasadim, an act of kindness. We're not talking about that. We're talking about lending. You're entitled to get it back. But you know something? The Torah forbids you, again from this week's Sedra, that if you know that he can't pay you back and the loan is due, you're not supposed to embarrass him by saying, where's my money? You wait it out. You speak to a neighbor discreetly or whatever. All kinds of things related to lending and borrowing that make us more spiritual, more holy, more sensitive. And here's my additional point. That is, the Torah does not have to command all of these side things, we'll call them, more than this one example of lending and borrowing. Because there are other relationships between people which we should learn the lessons of the mitzvot related to lending and borrowing, and not say business is business, the money is due, pay me up or mortgage, and if he begs for more time, sorry, we agreed on May 4th, the loan comes due, and it's due. I want my £50. The fact that I didn't lend it to you yet is a different story. So we are supposed to learn lessons, not just how to handle personal loans, but how to handle all personal interchange from person to person in many different areas. You don't go into the person's house in order to take his silver candlesticks or his coin collection for security for a loan. The courts will do that for you if it's deemed acceptable, but you don't do that because it's embarrassing. In other words, business is not supposed to be part of our vocabulary. We learn the lesson of better treatment of our fellows. And that's definitely an Elul lesson, but it's an all-year-round lesson. Another example of the lessons to be learned from mitzvot. Boss worker, employer employee. A boss must pay his worker on time, can't delay payment of his wages. And a worker is entitled to eat food that he's working with. Let's say he's picking grapes in the field, in the vineyard. He's entitled to eat grapes, but during his break, not when he's on the job. And he can't take any home, even if he says to himself, I brought a sandwich, I'm not hungry, so I'll take a cluster of grapes home to my family. Can't do that without permission of the boss. It goes on, but I want to finish this first half on this note, where the Torah tries to hit a balance between the worker and the boss. Both are entitled to things, and both can't overdo it. We'll be right back with more Torah Tibbetz audio for Parshat Ki Tetzé. You are listening to Torah Tidbits Audio for Parshat Ki Tetzé, with apologies from the person who played that piano piece twice as slow as I played it. I just felt I needed to speed it up. And I'm going to tell you later what it is, because I want to relate it to the Sedra. But I'll leave it as a question mark now, and of course we're all on the honor system to say I recognized it even before you mentioned it. I want to take a look at another phenomenon about mitzvot. And again, my goal, and I don't know if I'll be able to get it across in this half of the show, is to sort of stimulate the same kind of thinking about other mitzvot. This is what I mean. The Torah has many mitzvot in it. Relatively few does it give reasons for. I would, just as an example, say, Basukot teshvu shivat yamim, dwell in a sukkah 7 days, lema'an yedu dorotechem, in order that all generations should know of the experience of the people of Israel in the wilderness. And that's supposed to be a discussion on Sukkot, and maybe that's an example of a reason that's given. We have in this week's Sedra of Ki Tetzé the mitzvah to build a ma'akeh, a protective fence, a parapet is the English word, around a flat roof, so that there should not be bloodshed in your house because somebody could fall from it. I think it's kind of clear when the Torah goes to that extent and not just says, V'yasita ma'akeh l'gagecha, but gives more detail, that we see the reason for it, that it's dangerous to leave a roof without a protective fence because someone could get hurt or killed from falling off. Aside from, as I say, relatively few mitzvot, I don't have a number, there are many other mitzvot which the Torah does not give a reason for, but our sages through the generations took the plunge and made a reasonable guess as to why God commanded a specific thing. Example, again from this week's Sedra, Lo tachsom shor bedisho. When you have an ox and it is threshing wheat, what the old style was some kind of yoke and a post attached to the ox's neck to a pivot in the middle, and the ox would walk around a circle, and as he'd walk, he'd be stepping on the wheat sheaves that the person threw down in front of him and crack open the husks for the further processing of the wheat. That process is called threshing. And when an ox is used to thresh, you're not allowed to muzzle it. The Torah does not say why. Our sages explain that when an animal is working with food in close proximity like that, it sometimes gets the munchies, and it would like to bend down and eat some of the kernels that it's working with. The Torah forbids us to muzzle the animal to prevent it from eating. Our sages went as far as saying this is one of the mitzvot that forms the basis of avoiding cruelty to animals, avoiding tsa'ar balei chayim, or if you want to put it in a positive way, kindness to animals. There's even a situation that a Mishnah in Trumot speaks about, when you're not allowed to allow your animal to eat from a certain grain which belongs to a Kohen, then you're in a dilemma. You're not allowed to muzzle it, and you're not allowed to allow it to eat. So what are you supposed to do? So the Mishnah first recommends that you thresh manually with some kind of tool that used to be used, even though it's harder work than having an ox stomp on the grain. And if you don't do that and you use an animal, then the Mishnah says you have to tie a feed bag around its neck, and in the feed bag put the same kind of grain so that if it gets the munchies, it has what to eat. And the result being that you did not feed the truma type of grain to the animal of Yisrael, nor did you muzzle it. But the point is, or at least the first point is, the Torah never explained why we shouldn't muzzle an animal when it's working with food. And this, by the way, goes to any animal, to any kind of working with food, not just threshing. The Torah was using it as an example, and that's also something that we are explained in the oral law and in the rabbinic writings on the topic. So the Torah didn't say why, but our sages gave it their best shot. And even though there is a little bit of hesitation whenever an attempt is made to explain mitzvot, in this particular mitzvah, the hesitation was so minor you hardly notice it, because they assumed this is what why the mitzvah was given. And there are mitzvot like that, where Chazal consider it to be logical, common sense, reasonable for us to figure out why God commanded a certain thing. Now let's take another mitzvah related to animals in this week's Sedra also, and you'll see it gets a little complicated already. Lo tacharosh bishor uvachamor yachdav. You shall not plow with an ox and a donkey together. Again, many of the sages throughout the generation said, here's another example of a mitzvah that is there to teach us sensitivity towards the animals and avoid tzar balei chayim. Because if you harness an ox and a donkey, the donkey is lighter and friskier and faster paced, and it's going to pull against the ox, and the ox is so heavy that it will cause distress, if not to both of them, then at least to the donkey. And one has to avoid unnecessary tsa'ar balei chayim. You want to pull your plow with a yoke of oxen, put two of them together, three of them, ten of them, I don't care, but not an ox and a donkey. We are further taught that this mitzvah applies to any two non-compatible animals, not just ox and donkey. The Torah again was using it as an example, and not just for the purpose of plowing. I have in front of me, which you can't see, but I've shown it to many people, a picture that I photocopied from Dr. Seuss's first book, and to think that I saw it on Mulberry Street. The story, quickly, is about a boy named Marco who was going to school, and his father said, "When you come home from school, I hope you'll tell me some interesting things that you saw on your way to and from school." What does he see? He sees a little wagon being pulled by a horse, and there are some flower pots in the wagon, and a nondescript kind of person working there. He says, "I can't tell my father that. But if the wagon was being pulled by a zebra instead of the horse, that would be a better story. And then, better than a wagon, maybe a chariot, and not just a zebra, maybe a reindeer." And he goes on and on. And then comes this picture, which is not even the end of the story, but this is the one that I like to show. It's a circus wagon, a bandwagon, with a 7-piece band. There's a tuba, and there's a calliope, whatever it's called, and trumpets, and drums. And it's being pulled by an elephant with a rajah sitting on its back, harnessed to two giraffes. And there's a trailer with an old man listening to the music, because he imagines in his mind, how could you go with a bandwagon being pulled along? Then nobody will hear all of the music. They'll just when they pass. So here's a guy in a trailer who's being pulled by it. Now, when I saw this first, my first reaction was, elephant and giraffes are not compatible animals to harness together for any function. And this is probably, even though the giraffes are smiling and so is the elephant in this picture, it's probably forbidden. And sure enough it is, because our halakha, Jewish law, says that charosh, plowing, not specifically, could be anything, shor lav davka, and chamor lav davka, not necessarily those two animals, but any non-compatible animals. Okay. Until we get to the Rambam. The Rambam says this mitzvah on a Torah level applies to not just an ox and a donkey, but to any two non-compatible animals when one of them is kosher and one is not kosher, as an ox is kosher and a donkey is not kosher. Well, that already throws a little bit of a monkey wrench, pardon the expression, for understanding this purely on the basis of avoiding cruelty to animals. Because what would be the difference with an elephant and a horse harnessed together to an elephant and a giraffe. A giraffe is a kosher animal, an elephant is not. So that would satisfy the Rambam's minimum requirement of what constitutes a Torah-level violation. But a horse and an elephant, both of which are not kosher, according to Rambam, would not be prohibited on Torah level. He admits that the rabbis forbid it by rabbinic legislation. But everyone else besides the Rambam, I'm not saying everyone else, but other people, disagree with him and say it doesn't matter whether one animal is kosher and the other one is not, or both are kosher or both are not kosher. The prohibition goes across the board for non-compatible animals. Now, if that would be the case, which it is according to most authorities, then I could put it into the same category of mitzvah as the muzzling of an animal when it's working for food, because it stems from the same sensitizing us to the nature of animals and not being cruel to them. When the Rambam says, no, it has to follow this one kosher, one not kosher, it throws a little bit of a challenge to that answer alone. Now, the Rambam's answer, I don't know how well it fits anyway, but he says that this is a mitzvah that is a partner mitzvah to the prohibition of crossbreeding animals, and when you harness them together, you probably keep them in the same barn, and you might go ahead and crossbreed, which is forbidden, so this is forbidden also by Torah law. Not so satisfactory for a bunch of reasons which I don't want to go into now, but the point is that when the Sefer HaChinuch, which is one of the most popular presentations of the 613 mitzvot in the Torah, he writes the Rambam's reason, and then he says, with all due respect to my great teacher, and he actually was a teacher of a teacher, of the author of the Sefer HaChinuch, as far as we know, with all due respect to the Rambam, I need to add also the aspect of avoiding cruelty to animals, and not just the business about crossbreeding. And lema'aseh, practically, I don't know if we have examples of a kosher animal and a non-kosher animal that can crossbreed, so that's part of my problem. But my point, in this case, more important, because I'm going further with it, is the use, I'm sorry, the taking of a mitzvah that does not come along with a reason, assuming and attaching a reason which might not be the whole story. And therefore, the hesitation of giving a reason is even greater, because we have to say, we're not sure why God commanded this, but we think it might be this, but the Rambam thinks it might be that, and we'll have to mention both of them in order to cover the bases, and there might be others as well. Then there are mitzvot that are very enigmatic and don't lend themselves to logic and common sense, and here we hesitate even more to attempt to give any kind of reason. Take an example from this sedra, the prohibition of sha'atnez, the wearing of garments that contain wool and linen. Wool and linen in a garment. Watch how the logic doesn't hold in this kind of thing. Can you make a tapestry to hang on your wall, which is wool and linen embroidered in different colors on it? The answer is yes, you can. You can weave wool and linen together. You could even make garments for non-Jews, because they are not obligated to avoid wearing shatnez. You just can't make them for Jews. And you could even make the covering of the Holy Ark, the Aron Kodesh and a shul, containing shatnez, because there's nothing intrinsic in shatnez, just our prohibition of wearing it. Why? Interesting, the previous mitzvah that I spoke about, Lo Tacharosh B'shor V'chamor Yachdav, is immediately followed in the same little paragraph by Lo Tilbash, thou shalt not, a verb, wear shatnez, which is Tzemer Ufishtim, just like the previous pasuk said, B'shor V'chamor, Yachtav, same last word, yachtav, together. And that is only wearing that's forbidden, and anything that's construed as wearing, and only wool and only linen. No matter what you kind of reasoning you want to give for this, you're stuck to explain how come it works with linen, but it's not prohibited with cotton. And why the wool of a sheep is part of the prohibition, and the goat's hair, for example, is not. Cashmere is not. So even if you want to try to attach a reason, which I don't want to now, although I will say that some commentaries include it in a distancing of ourselves from all forms of idolatry. Now, that might not be something that people thought of, but it turns out, so I'll give a little explanation, that wool as the chief fiber from the animal kingdom and linen, the chief fiber from the plant kingdom, when you weave them together, you are demonstrating a mastery over nature. Nature is there to serve the human beings. And when you take it to this ultimate limit level, this includes the cooking of milk and meat, and it includes the cross-grafting of fruits, and it includes various other combinations where God says, hey, I gave you permission to eat that and to eat that, but you're not allowed to mix them together. Why? No explanation in the Torah. There are symbolic explanations and lessons that come from various other of these chukim, the enigmatic kind of mitzvot, but and all kind of suppositions and maybe this and maybe that, but nothing is crystal clear and definitive. Let's take one more mitzvah, and that's the pair of mitzvot called Shiluach HaKen. When a person happens upon a bird's nest, in the wild, on the ground, or in a tree. I'm adding now in parentheses, and he would like to take the eggs. He's not allowed to take the eggs unless he sends away the mother bird first. Shaleach tishalach et ha'em, ve'et habanim tikach lach. If he wants the mother bird, and the mother bird is around her nest with chicks or eggs, he's not allowed to take her. He's not allowed to take the nest and the chicks and the mother bird together. Only thing that's allowed, and it's a very puzzling thing, is you want the eggs or the chicks, send away the mother bird. This mitzvah applies to birds in the wild, but not birds that are owned by a person. This mitzvah applies to a kosher bird, but not to a non-kosher bird. This mitzvah applies to a female hovering over the nest and not a male, even in species where the father bird, the male bird, takes a turn on the nest. There are various details here where you scratch your head and you say, this is not as simple to understand as the business with muzzling an animal when it's working for food. If that would be a gesture of kindness to the mother bird, like if it's out of sight, out of mind, and it doesn't pay attention anymore to the eggs, then it should apply to non-kosher birds as well. There's a lot more that I don't have time to go into. The point is, not every mitzvah lends itself to an understanding. Many do. And our sages took them and sometimes carried them further. Like, let's get back to the protective fence on the roof. You're not allowed to put money in your mouth. This is a rabbinic law in the Shulchan Aruch. You can't put money in your mouth. Why can't you put money in your mouth? It explains it. It says because it's handled by so many people that maybe the saliva of a dangerously ill person got onto this money and dried up, and you reawaken the wetness by putting it in your mouth and you could get harmed. Simply said, germs. We used to think that take that coin out of your mouth or take that bill out of your mouth was something mothers say to their children. They do, but the halacha says it to the Jewish people. And anyone who, in his right mind, should follow the same thing. We actually touched upon a whole bunch of the 74 mitzvot, not all of them certainly, and not most of them, but many of them. And I have about another 10 seconds to say, hope you got something out of this. The point is that mitzvot are to teach us things, as well as tell us what to do and what not to do. And on that note, I wish you a Shabbat Shalom, Chodesh Tov, Lehishtameah.